Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is Tzav, command. It is from Leviticus chapter 6, verse 8 to Leviticus chapter 8, verse 36. The Haftarah is Jeremiah chapter 7, starting at verse 21, to Jeremiah chapter 8, verse 3, and Jeremiah chapter 9, verses 22 and 23. The Brit Hadashah is Hebrews chapter 7, starting at verse 23 to verse 28, and Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 to 6. Before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech HaOlam. We thank you, Abba, that you are the creator of all things, and you created your feasts and your Sabbaths and your Torah. And we thank you that you have called us and are allowing us, letting us keep your ways, that you have made us a part of your assembly, Abba. We just thank you and praise you for protecting and providing for everyone who is keeping your Sabbath and your feasts. And I ask that whatever words come out of my mouth that are not true, that are not good, that are not what comes from you, that those words would fall by the wayside and would not gain any ground, that they would not be like the yeast flowing through the air, like words leavening people. Abba, I pray, please do not let me say anything that is not of you. In Yeshua's name, amen. The Torah portion this week is being called Priest Preparations, Passover Preparations. I named it that because, as in this Torah portion, the priests are making their preparations to take their office. We are preparing to do our Passover. So there's preparations on both sides. But I'm going to not focus on what the priests are doing in this Torah portion as much as what we are doing to prepare for Passover. And the reason I'm doing this is because I get a number of people asking me questions. And they're usually the large number of people asking questions, but they're asking the same questions. So I want to address these questions. Let's go to Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 18. I will gather them that are sorrowful for the solemn assembly who are of you, to whom the reproach of it was a burden. I want to talk about this verse because there are some people who are sorrowful for the solemn assembly. And so we need to know what that word sorrowful or sorrow means. It is Strong's 3013, and the word is yaga in Hebrew, and it means to grieve. So the Lord is dealing with them and gathering them that are grieving for the solemn assembly. Now, what is that solemn assembly? Well, let's go back to Zephaniah and take a look at that word there for solemn assembly and see if we can get some more information about that. Here the word is solemn assembly is moed. That's all that word means, that phrase there, solemn assembly. Now, in the old English times, it used to be that the English, if they wanted to say that something was really important, they would use the word solemn. But the word there in the interlinear simply is moed. And it means the appointed times, you see. So in the interlinear, we have the word mem, mem, vav, ayin, dalet. Now, there's two mems on there. So that means that they are important, you see. And so that's why the translator gave it the word as solemn assembly. We could say important assembly because of the doubling of the mem. So the point is that those who grieve for the important assembly, those assemblies that keep the moed, that keep the appointed times, who are of you? Who are of who? Who are of the Lord? And to whom it is the reproach of it is a burden. What does this mean? The reproach of it is a burden. It means that we don't have a way to do this properly. The reproach of them, we're sorrowful, and there's a reproach associated with these appointed times. And the reproach of it is a burden. Folks, we are carrying this burden, you see. That's what this is talking about here. It says here, in that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, fear not, fear you not, and to Zion, let not your hands be slack. In that day, when is that? And where am I talking about? Zephaniah 3:16. It says, in that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, fear you not, and to Zion. Okay, to those who are in Jerusalem and to those who are in Zion. Who is Zion? Zion is also a word for congregation. It's a word for Temple Mount and for congregation and for Zionism and so forth. Let not your hands be slack. The Lord your God in the midst of you is mighty. He will save. He will rejoice over you with joy. He will rest in his love. He will joy over you with singing. And I will gather them that are mourning or sorrowful or upset or whatever other word you want to put in there for the important assembly, who are of you, to whom the reproach of it is a burden, who are struggling with this thing as a burden. 19, behold, at that time I will undo all that afflict you, and I will save her that halts, and so forth. I'm not going to continue reading now, but the point that I'm trying to make is that the Lord is going to gather those who have a problem over the solemn assemblies, you see. And the reason that they have a problem over the solemn assemblies is because they don't have a way to keep them properly. And so every year we have these struggles, and so we need to go over them. We need to try to get it right. But you know what? The struggle is that we're not going to get it right until Yeshua comes back. The Lord is talking here in Zephaniah chapter 3, verses 16 to 19, about people who are in Jerusalem and people who are in Zion, those who are scattered all over the earth. Ain't nobody in Jerusalem doing it right, and ain't nobody out here in the diaspora doing it right, okay? We're just doing the best we can. But there are questions, and so I am going to try to answer some of these questions for you so that maybe some of your angst can be put aside, some of your grieving, some of your affliction, some of your vexation over this can be assuaged, and you can maybe come to a conclusion about what you believe needs to be done. Because I know in my heart of hearts that you want to do this right. Now, you've heard me say that the more important matters of the Torah are the weightier matters. And of course, that's true. But if we're suffering over the mechanics of the Torah, it's not going to help us to do the weightier matters, is it? It's not going to help us to be more loving and kind toward each other if we've got a sore spot. Well, I am going to share with you the conclusions that I have reached on certain questions. And at the end of this, you can either agree with me or not agree with me, and it'll be okay. But at least you will know why I reached the conclusion I reached. And perhaps you will agree with the conclusion I reached. And if not, that's okay too. The first issue that I want to discuss is the Last Supper. There are many people who still believe that the Last Supper was a Passover Seder. Well, beyond the fact that Yeshua couldn't have kept the Passover and been the Passover at the same time, let's look at some of the other issues. One of the major things in helping us to determine whether or not the Last Supper was actually a Passover Seder is to get the definition of the bread that Yeshua broke with his disciples. The bread that Yeshua used at that Last Supper, according to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, had leaven in it. That bread in each one of those verses in Matthew, Mark, and Luke uses the Greek word for leavened bread, which is artos. In Matthew 26:26, it says, as they were eating, Jesus took bread. That is artos there in the Greek. It is raised bread, bread with leaven in it. In Mark 14:22, it says exactly the same thing. In Luke 22:19, it says artos there in the Greek. So if you want to contend that that Last Supper was a Seder meal that Yeshua was doing with his disciples, then you're going to have to explain why Yeshua gave raised bread instead of unleavened bread, why he gave leavened bread and not unleavened bread to his disciples. I mean, if you can explain that, then it's fine. But you know, when Yeshua was talking about the leaven of the Pharisees and false doctrine in Matthew chapter 16, verse 12, the Greek used the same word, artos. Let's see what that scripture says. Matthew 16:12. Then understood they how that he bade them not beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. Now, he was talking there in Matthew chapter 16. Let's just go over to Matthew chapter 16, and we'll take a look. And it says in verse 6, he says, then Jesus said to them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. They said in verse 7, they were reasoning among themselves, saying, it is because we have taken no bread. See, they were misconstruing what he said. And further down here, he says in verse 11, how is it that you do not understand that I spoke not to you concerning bread, that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees? In other words, he's going, how come you don't understand what I'm telling you? That is when they understood that he bade them not beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And that word, all through Matthew 16, is artos, leavened bread. Guess what leavened bread means? False doctrine. Yet the New Testament does speak of unleavened bread. That word for unleavened bread is Strong's 106, and the word is azumos in Greek, and it means unleavened, that which is uncorrupted, and it is associated with Passover week or the week of unleavened bread. This brings up another issue. You know, we have Passover day, and we have Passover week, and we have the first day of unleavened bread and unleavened week. And there are terms that are used in ways that you would have to be present in that culture to understand what they were saying. Passover is not a day. Passover is the name of the sacrifice that you bring to the temple or to the tabernacle. It's the Pesach sacrifice. Now, they call Passover day, the day before the first day of unleavened bread, they call that the day of Passover or Passover day. Why do they do that? Well, it became a colloquialism for preparation day for the Passover feast, the sacrifice, which would result in the feast. And then, of course, Passover week is also a misnomer because there's no such thing as Passover week. It always is unleavened bread week, you know, the week of unleavened bread. And so these things we have to take into account as well. We, in our own American English, say things that in future generations will seem like, what were they talking about? It was hot, but somebody said it was cool. Or it was cool, but somebody said it was hot. You know what I mean? So we have to take these cultural issues into perspective. Now, in Matthew chapter 26, verse 17, it says, "Now the first day of the feast of unleavened bread." That's azumos there in the Greek. That is bread without leaven. "The disciples came to Jesus, saying to him, 'Where will you that we prepare for you to eat the Passover?'" And then in Mark chapter 14, verse 1, it says, "After 2 days was the feast of the Passover and of unleavened bread." Again, azumos. "And the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might take him by craft and put him to death." Mark chapter 14, verse 12 says, "And the first day of unleavened bread," azumos, "when they killed the Passover." By the way, they're telling you here, when they kill the Passover. It is at the first day of unleavened bread. It is not on the day of Passover, as they called it in their slang and in their cultural language of the time. Passover day simply was preparation day for the Passover or the Pesach sacrifice that resulted in the feast, that resulted in the Passover meal, you see. And so here in Mark chapter 14, verse 1, it's telling us that the day of the killing of the Passover was on the day of unleavened bread. Now, we're going to talk about what it means to be between the evenings in a little bit. But for now, they understood that the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover, okay? The first day of unleavened bread was when they killed the Passover. You know what? I'm not gonna talk about this issue of between the evenings and timing and stuff like that later on. I'm gonna do it right here. We have a way of keeping time that is so foreign to people who don't have watches and they don't have calendars. We look at calendars and watches and clocks, and we get online, and the thing has been broken down into, as close as possible, 24 increments called hours, and then there are 60 increments in each hour called minutes, and that's all a man-made construct. The way that the Lord set this up was that there was an evening and a morning. The day didn't start at midnight when the Lord started this thing. The day started in the evening. The first evening was the first day, and it went through the morning and all the way through until it got dark again. And then it was the second day, you see. So it was from evening to morning. So when the Lord gave the instruction for the timing of the Passover, the first time, the original one, and then for the memorial, which the two are not the same things. I've put in depth studies online that teach about the difference between the original Passover and the memorial Passovers and why people should not be putting blood on their doorposts. And I don't have time in this teaching to go into that, but you can get that teaching online at The Messianic Message, and it's called Passover, Its Meaning Then and Now. And you can arrive at understanding why I have reached the conclusion we should not be putting blood on the doorposts. And I have said a lot about this. I've already said too much about it now. I want to talk with you, though, about the timing, because people get confused about what this timing is. So getting back to the man-made way that we keep time is not the same way that the Hebrews kept time, even when they were in Egypt. In Exodus chapter 6, it says, "And you shall keep it up until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening." Now, let's go to Exodus chapter 29, verse 39. "The one lamb you shall offer in the morning, and the other lamb you shall offer at evening," or at even, it says there in the King James. That word there for even or evening is Strong's 6153, and it literally means, and it should say, between the evenings. It's Bein Harbaim, okay? And I've, in my notes, I have put this for you to be able to see that that Hebrew word there. Literally, what between the evenings meant to a Hebrew was this: any time from noon on, from noon to dark, that was between the evenings. That's when the evening sacrifice, that lamb sacrifice, went on the altar, was between noon and dark. And, you know, we can safely assume, and record shows, that most of the time that lamb was on the altar at about 3 or so, what we would call 3 o'clock in the afternoon. When it came time to do the Passover lambs in the temple, they were not sacrificed until after that evening sacrifice, that daily evening lamb, had been put on the altar between the evenings, between noon and dark. So that gives you some hint about the timing of, you know, when they sacrificed the Passover lambs at the first day of unleavened bread. Now, why would noon to dark be called part of the first day of unleavened bread? Well, because, again, here we have a cultural issue. We have somebody talking in the culture of their time when they knew that from noon on, or from whenever that daily sacrificed lamb gets put on the altar, they started counting that as the first day of unleavened bread. You see, we've got to get our heads into this Hebrew culture. We've got people saying that the sacrifice needs to happen at the end of the 13th in the evening going into the 14th. That is not going to work, because if that's the way it was done the first time, as timing, that's the way that it's been done in the memorial as well as timing. And if that's the case, then here's what happened. Back there in Egypt, those people sacrificed their lambs just as evening was coming, the evening of the 14th. And then they sat there for 24 hours until the evening of the 15th. And then they waited anywhere from 6 to however many more hours they waited to be able to leave Egypt. Does that make sense to you? Listen, The scriptures tell us that they left on the 15th. In fact, we know that because Exodus chapter 12, verse 41 says, "And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day it came to pass, that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." And in verse 51 it says, "And it came to pass the selfsame day that the Lord did bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their armies." What was that selfsame day? Numbers chapter 33, verse 3. "And they departed from Ramses in the first month on the 15th day of the first month." And then it goes on to say, "On the morrow after the Passover, after the children of Israel went out with a high hand in the sight of all the Egyptians." So now we have to go look at that word morrow. What does it mean that they left on the morrow? It says they left on the 15th day of the month, on the morrow after the Passover. So did they really like sacrifice the lambs and, you know, do that at the end of the 13th going into the 14th, and then they sat there for the 24 to 40 hours or whatever long it was going to be, and then they left on the morrow, which would be after the 14th, because they left on the 15th? Well, let's take a look at that word morrow. That word there for morrow is mokorot, and it's Strong's 4283, and Strong's has it as morrow, or adverbially tomorrow, or the next day. So let's look at the ancient Hebrew lexicon of the Bible. Because in there, it tells us that it is associated with burn, the word burn. And it tells us that it has to do with the heat of the sun, the heat of anger, also tomorrow or later time as a delay. Okay, so let's just figure out how long were they delayed. Well, the Bible indicates that they were very much in a hurry, that the Egyptians wanted them gone as soon as the angel had passed through in the night, which meant the angel could not have passed through in the night to destroy the firstborn during the night time of the 14th, because the people left right away. They left as soon as it was starting to get into the heat of the day. You see, and so that day was the 15th of the month. So the sacrifice happened between the evenings, meaning after noon of the 14th, headed into the evening, the dark time of the 15th, and they waited until during the night time, sometime on the 15th, when the destroyer came through, killed all the firstborns, and then the Egyptians kicked them out on that same day. That's how that happened. So either they sacrificed their lamb between the evenings on the first day of unleavened bread, which was any time after noon of the 14th, going into the 15th, and then they left on the day of the 15th, which is what I believe. Or they sat there for 24 to maybe 40 hours waiting to be able to leave. It does not make sense that that's the way it was done. Now, all of the quotes about the bread, we're going to get back to the bread now. To me, it's clear that the Last Supper was not a Passover Seder. It was a regular meal with leavened bread. That means then that Yeshua did not share the hafikomen. The hafikomen was not what Yeshua was sharing at that meal, okay? But now we have to address another thing, because all of the quotes about the bread at the Last Supper have been from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Now we have to ask ourselves, what happened with the book of John? Well, all that John says about the supper's timing is this. He has other things to say about that Last Supper, but he says this about the timing of it. In John chapter 13, verse 1, he says, "Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come." Okay? What is that word before? It is pro in the Greek. And it literally means for, in front of, prior to, before, above, ago. It means basically what it says. Before the feast of Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them to the end. And then the book of John goes on to tell us about how Yeshua got up after the supper had ended, and the devil, having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet. In other words, John is telling you about the timing. He says this supper happened before the feast of Passover. You see, so there is no way that this feast is, a Passover Seder. So now we're going to address what is leaven. Yeast is a living organism, like humans. Humans are living organisms. Yeast is a living organism. And yeast is everywhere. It's in our air. It gets onto bread dough. In fact, in ancient times, that's how they used to make their bread dough. They used to set the flour with the, in the water, and the yeast would settle on there, and then they would make their dough out of that and bake it, and it would raise the dough a little bit, and they would have to probably take a lump of that dough and put it into the next batch and set that out in the air so that it could get more of the yeast on it, and it would leaven that until they had a lump of dough that would just, after a while, they could just use that starter, without having to add more yeast from the air into it. Okay? So after the dough had enough yeast in it, then it became what Yeshua referred to as a lump. And so it became a lump for the next batch, you see. And that is what Paul was talking about in Galatians 5:9 when he said a little leaven leavens the whole lump. You see, that's how bread works. You have a little leaven, a little yeast, and you have a little pinched off piece of starter. You put it in with your fresh batch, and it will leaven that whole lump of dough into a new raised loaf. Okay? Now, I compare yeast that travels through the air like spoken words. And like words, once it is out there, it's out there. And anyone can run into it, you see. All you got to do is say something, and eventually it's going to come back, right? Yeast and words both leaven things, okay? Words with a message of false doctrine infiltrate the human soul. They leaven the human soul. Yeast also leavens bread. So you see the comparison between words of false doctrine leavening the human soul and yeast leavening bread. This is what Yeshua was talking about. And this is why I believe leaven is represented only by yeast and not by other chemical additives like baking soda and cream of tartar, which make baking powder, or even vinegar and baking soda together, can cause something to get puffed up. You see, baking soda and cream of tartar and other chemicals do cause grain to rise. But here's the confusion. They are puffing up. They are not rising. What is the difference between puffing up and rising, or puffing up and false doctrine? Well, false doctrine is the leaven of the Pharisees. Yeshua already told us this in Matthew, right? When he says, in Matthew chapter 16, to take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, and in verse 12, when he explains that it's the doctrine of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees, you see, that's what he's warning people about. It's not about things that rise up or get puffed up. You see, it's about the false doctrine. There's a danger in the teachers that I've heard saying that leaven is sin that puffs you up. I've heard this year after year after year. Leaven is not sin that puffs you up. Leaven is false doctrine that leads you astray and causes you to sin. You won't sin if you don't get the false doctrine in the first place. You won't sin if you don't have that leaven in the first place. By the way, if leaven was just something that puffs us up, then, you know, during the week of unleavened bread, we can't eat pasta. Why? It gets puffed up in water. We can't eat popcorn. Why? It gets puffed up over high heat. And you can't make a cake and think that you're going to avoid puffing it up by putting vinegar and baking soda in there. So you can't have cake either because it's puffed up, you see. And so we have to make the distinction between what the Lord said and what people said. There has never been a chemical additive made that could cause the consistency of a loaf of raised yeast bread, you know, bread made with yeast. It just doesn't have that same consistency. Chemical additives are added to things like cakes and quick breads and things like that, but they don't have the same consistency as yeasted bread, do they? And so I think it's ridiculous that we're being taught that leaven is sin that puffs up, because that is not what Yeshua said. It's about people's personal opinions that they add to the Torah. That is what leaven is. That is what false doctrine is. That's what the Pharisees and Sadducees did in Yeshua's day, and it's still what they're doing today. You know, the Jewish people practice a puffed up religion. That word, I'm going to prove this to you, because the word doctrine there in Matthew chapter 16 verse 12 is didaki, and that's the Greek word didaki. It's Strong's 1322, and it means instruction. So leaven is bad instruction. It's bad advice on how to follow the Torah, you know, like they want you to tie your shoes this way, or get out of bed this way, or use the bathroom that way. You see, bad instruction. It's an addition to, you see. So what is bread besides flour raised with yeast? Well, the 12 tribes sat before the Lord on the table of showbread. Now, there's debate whether they were 12 leavened breads or 12 unleavened breads, but we do know that at Shavuot, leavened bread is brought to that feast. So it's okay with me if the 12 tribes were leavened, sitting there on the table of showbread, because the Lord accepts the leavened bread, which represents his people, at Shavuot. And so it makes sense to me that they were leavened loaves of bread. But Yeshua is unleavened bread, because he is the bread of life. He is an unleavened loaf. Now, we have talk of leavened cakes in Scripture. And so I have mentioned cake, saying, you know, cake is not to be, you don't have to avoid it during Passover or Unleavened Bread Week, because even though it has chemical things that puff it up, it is not leavened. Puffing up and leavening are not the same thing. And so in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, there and elsewhere, there is talk of cakes, okay? And I wanted to go over that with you because it's an issue that came to my mind. In Strong's number 5692, we see that those cakes, like the cakes that Sarah made in Genesis 18, verse 6, where it says, Abraham hastened to the tent to Sarah and said, make ready quickly 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes upon the hearth. What is that? Is that cake like what we have today? Or is that bread formed into something else? Well, let's go and look at Strong's 5692. The Hebrew word is ugah, and it means a disc or cake of bread. Now, what it is like what we have today that we call tortillas. They have leaven in them. They have yeast in them, because only yeast makes bread leavened or makes it rise. Baking powder and other chemical additives don't make flour rise into a loaf of bread. It makes them puff up into some kind of other confection. But these discs that Sarah made for Abraham, these were what we would call today tortillas, you see. And so they probably, you know, maybe even wrapped up the meat that, and maybe perhaps even cheese into their disc or their ugah, you see. So I hope that even if you disagree with me, at least you'll know why I have reached the conclusion that leavened or risen loaves of bread are not the same as chemicalized puffed up wheat, you see. All right, now, which calendar? I have friends who are keeping the feast on all different days, and, you know, I just go ahead and go and keep the feast with them on whatever day they're doing it. I believe, though, that we should be on the Hillel calendar when it comes to the feasts. So, the reason for this is because in Deuteronomy chapter 17, starting at verse 8, it says, if there arise a matter too hard for you in judgment between blood and blood, between plea and plea, between stroke and stroke, matters of controversy within your gates, then you shall arise and go to the place that the Lord shall choose. Where's the place the Lord chose? He chose Jerusalem. And you shall come to the priests, the Levites, and unto the judge that shall be in those days, and inquire. Now, until the Lord set up the place called Jerusalem, which was not until several hundred years later, the priests and the judges would sit in the gates, as we also know. But he said there would be a place where he would put his name, and that's where you were to go, and you were to talk to the priests, the Levites, and to the judge, and they will show you the sentence of judgment. And you shall do according to the sentence, which they of that place which the Lord shall choose and show you, okay? You shall observe to do everything according to all that they have informed you. Yes, I'm paraphrasing that a little bit there if you're reading the notes. According to the sentence of the law which they shall teach you, and according to the judgment which they shall tell you, you shall do. You shall not decline from the sentence which they shall show you, to the right hand or to the left. And the man that will do presumptuously and will not hearken to the priest that stands to minister there before the Lord your God, or to the judge, even that man shall die, and shall put away the evil from Israel. And all the people shall hear and fear and do no more presumptuously. By the way, to be presumptuous means to be high-handed. High-handedness is considered treason against the Lord. So, when the Lord sets up Jerusalem, You're not only going to have now your priests and judges possibly in the city gates where you live, but now if there's a controversy and it's too hard for you in your city gates, now you go to Jerusalem. Once it's in Jerusalem, then it becomes part of the law of the nation of Israel. It becomes part of the law of the Commonwealth of Israel. By the way, you and I say we are citizens of the Commonwealth of Israel, right? The Great Assembly was set up in Israel by Ezra when they returned from Babylon. Now, this Great Assembly is no more just a Jewish thing than the Sabbath and the feast are just Jewish things. You know, you can't make that argument, not after having read what the Lord said about the place where he's going to put his name, and you're going to go there and see the priest and the judge, and you're going to listen to what they tell you to do, and you're going to do that. The Great Assembly was comprised of such prophets as Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. By the way, Malachi is another word for another name for Ezra. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Nehemiah, Hechaliah, Mordecai, and Zerubbabel, Shealtiel, among others. Okay? And sometimes the Great Assembly was simply designated as Ezra and his court of law. The Great Assembly decided how to canonize the Tanakh. The Great Assembly implemented the Amidah standing prayers to keep everybody focused on the Lord's temple, the centerpiece of his nation and the earth. The Great Assembly implemented the Feast of Purim, and they implemented the first Hillel calendar. That first Hillel calendar was a sighted moon and a calculated calendar. It was the calendar that existed before Yeshua was even born. And by the way, Yeshua observed this calendar. He never once called this calendar part of the Pharisees' false doctrine. He never once did not go to the temple on the day when the Hillel calendar said to be here. Now, whether or not we agree with the Hillel calendar, and by the way, I personally do not, because it's based on sighting. The Bible never says that when you see the moon, you're supposed to, you know, that's the first day and all of that. No, it doesn't say anything about seeing it. So I know from being in grade school that a new moon is a dark moon, and every meteorologist on the face of the planet will tell you that a new moon is a dark moon. And by the way, only a dark moon can be known before it's going to get there. You have no idea when you are sighting the moon, waiting for that crescent, what night it's going to come on. But if you are waiting on the new moon, you will definitely know when the new moon is coming, because you're going to be able to recognize that last final sliver of the waning moon. And then you'll know that the next night is the new moon, the dark moon. Anyway, the Hillel calendar was cited and calculated and authorized by the Great Assembly every month. It wasn't just like implemented one time and then it was done every month. And so I don't like the Hillel calendar particularly, but maybe Yeshua is going to keep it in the kingdom. I don't know. I'm not going to disagree with him if he does that. And right now, because it was authorized and implemented every month by the Great Assembly, who was authorized by the Lord to make such rulings and to make us beholden to those rulings, I'm just going to go ahead and keep the Hillel calendar. Now, I understand people don't agree with me on this, and it's okay. If you invite me to Passover on the day before the Hillel calendar, or the day after Hillel calendar, or the 2 days after the Hillel calendar, I will still come and I will do Passover with you, because I want to be with my brethren. And by the way, you know, I've had people ask me, well, what do you do when, you know, your congregation does it on a different night than you? Well, if your congregation is doing it on another calendar, if they're sighting the moon and following the Karaites, well, just go with them, be with them on that night. And if you really truly believe that you need to be, you know, doing Passover on the night of the Hillel calendar, then even if you have to do it alone, do it on the night that the Hillel calendar specifies. But what if it turns out that the Hillel calendar is wrong? In fact, what if it turns out that everything I've said in this Torah portion is wrong? Well, you know, there's a provision made for the congregation who is led astray by leaders. By the way, I try to be very careful about what I tell people, because I have a very heavy a weight on me, just because I have greater accountability toward the Lord, and I want to make sure that I'm telling you the right thing. But what if I'm wrong? Leviticus chapter 4 verse 13 says, and if the whole congregation of Israel sin through ignorance, and the thing be hid from the eyes of the assembly, you know, the leaders, and they have done somewhat against any of the commandments of the Lord concerning things which should not be done, and are guilty, when the sin which they have sinned against it is known, then the congregation shall offer a young bullock for the sin, and bring him before the tabernacle of the congregation. So, you see, even if you are being led astray, I know that you're doing the very best that you know to do, and even if you disagree with me on these things, it's going to be okay. I have explained to you how I have reached my conclusions. Just keep the feast. It's a joyful feast. It's your redemption. You get to repent of your personal sins. You get to come close to the Lord. You get to be with your brethren. And you have the privilege that He has called you to do this. He hasn't called everybody to do this. You are among the remnant. Just be grateful and happy for that, and celebrate and be joyful. I hope this Torah portion has been a blessing to you. Shabbat Shalom.